system where we could make the full spectrum of infection reportable, which would be good information for us to have, but does so through a method which protects the identity of individuals. And I'm very supportive of that portion of the report, and we intend to proceed with adoption of rules.
And the final one, relating to page 80 of the Policy Committee report, do you expect the HIV/AIDS Policy Committee to continue to exist? And if so, how often do you expect to convene meetings of the committee?
Yes, I expect it to continue to exist. In fact, some funding to support it is included in the governor's revised AIDS budget, which has been presented to the Ways and Means Committee. It is meeting in April. We have not set a frequency of dates after that, but I'm sure it will be at least quarterly, and I would guess more frequently based on the number of AIDS-related issues that keep coming up.
Thank you very much, Christine.
Thank you, Representative Gould. Other questions?
What's HIV testing?
You want to answer that?
That was a term that...
That's testing for... HIV is the proper name of the virus which causes AIDS. And it is testing for the antibody to that virus. That's the testing we're now doing in the community.
Representative French?
Christine, if a quarantine facility was established, who pays for that? Does that come out of the general fund or out of the health department?
If a quarantine takes place, the cost of maintaining the person in quarantine is borne by the local health department if they're the ones who did the quarantine, or by the state health division if we were the ones that ordered it. And right now, quarantine is ordered about once or twice a year, usually for tuberculosis patients. And the cost of caring for that patient while quarantine is borne at the local level.
That's true. That's under present law.
Under present law and under this statute.
Okay, other questions?
One final question. You propose in Section 10 to put into statute the commitment procedure, and you mentioned that it was similar to the civil commitment procedure. Maybe you've already answered it, Chris, but you said something. I just initially wondered, why don't you just write administrative rules? You mentioned you already have the authority. Mm-hmm. You have the broad authority. You could just write administrative rules, I presume. Why do you want to put it in statute when you could have your own rules?
We have already proposed some rules that accomplished part of that. But I respect the number of people who approached us on this issue and said that the rights of individuals being restricted in this manner are sufficiently important to us that we really think that ought to be embodied in statute. There's nothing with rules that says I, at a later date, couldn't repeal them or some successor to me couldn't throw them out. By doing it in statute, we really confirm that the state of Oregon sees this as an extreme measure and only wants to use it very carefully with due protection of anybody involved. And that makes sense to me to put it in statute.
Okay, Christine. Now, you indicated in your testimony at the very beginning that the reason people started looking at this statute is because of the AIDS epidemic. I've got a very simple question for you. You know, I've looked at all the changes in this bill. I'd like you to answer, what does this bill do that addresses the problem of AIDS and the spread of AIDS? I mean, what does it do to help, you know, prevent that spread?
The statute in and of itself, I don't think, does anything to prevent the spread. What prevents the spread of AIDS is, in fact, people changing their behavior and not spreading the disease.
Okay, and let me interrupt you for just a second. Then is there anything in the bill that speaks to changing people's behavior or gives the state any authority to mandate those changes in behavior?
By confirming in statute appropriate protection of individual rights and our full capacity to make diseases reportable, I think we then set up a system in which all of the parties concerned about AIDS can come forward and work comfortably with us. There is no way to mandate a change in sexual behavior any more than we've been successful mandating changes in other disease-causing behavior. What we need to mandate are the reports, so we know where the disease is in the community, and then set up systems to work with the identified people. And I think what this statute does is confirm our reporting system and our protection of individuals in such a way that the community at risk for AIDS can and will come forward to work with us. It also provides protection for the county health departments with regard to AIDS. The present VD statute, if you read it, puts the local health department at complete liability for the full cost of treatment of AIDS. That puts them in a very awkward position dealing with this disease and doesn't seem appropriate in the way we now treat illnesses. So by getting that out of the statute, we enable the health, the local health departments to work with this disease more fully.
One other question. Representative Van Loon, I give you plenty of opportunity. The chair gets a chance to ask questions also. In your written testimony or written letter here, or the letter by Lester Wright, in repealing Chapter 434, you are eliminating, as I understand this letter, the specific examination of prisoners, testing of prisoners. Is that correct?
The specific requirement that they be tested for venereal diseases, that's correct.
Okay, would people incarcerated in the Oregon State Penitentiary, as a matter of course, be tested for AIDS?
Not as a matter of course for that disease. They are routinely examined on admission and evaluated for diseases, and AIDS testing is treated in that setting as it is anywhere else. If the person has a reason to think they might be exposed and reason for the test, then it's done, but it's not just done blanket on everybody any more than it is in the general population.
Okay, but they were routinely tested for venereal disease in the past?
I don't think in recent years that particular section of the statute has been fully implemented in this state. I'd have to check with someone.
Okay, I would appreciate it if you would check.
Yes.
Because I'm concerned why we wouldn't have routine testing of people in those particular circumstances.
Routine testing for HIV virus, the virus that causes AIDS, has not been supported in any setting except the blood bank by responsible officials all across the country. Testing of people for whom you have no reason to think they would be infected is an unnecessary expense, and because of false positives, also the unnecessary burden of emotional strain to a person who might be given a false positive result. While the population in prison may be somewhat more at risk of IV drug abuse, and you may think they may be more sexually promiscuous than the average population, I don't think we have enough reason to think that all of them are in that category to just routinely test everyone at admission. A part of their health screening ought to be a review of whether or not they think they're at risk for this disease and whether or not the test would be appropriate. And it is available in the Oregon Corrections Institute.
Okay, Christine, then let me ask a very specific question. You indicated that the population that we're talking about there may, I think your word was may, be more prone to drug usage. Do you have any, or may not be, or I'm not sure what you said, do you have any statistics, has your committee looked at the question of how many people in prison have been using drugs through intravenous injection at one time in their life?
I believe that information is available. I don't have it at my fingertips today. There have been several substantive looks at the question of AIDS testing in prisons. And the only part of the country where that is being extensively done is on the East Coast, New Jersey, New York, where a very high percentage of their AIDS cases are IV drug users and a very high percentage of their prison population are IV drug users. So it's become a more routine thing there. But the evidence I've seen from other studies and from other looks, as it would apply to a population like Oregon's, is that it would not be appropriate. I will get you information on drug use in prison and what
not
could be calculated.
Not in prison, but previous drug use.
Right, of the at some point in their life of the population right now in prison.
And then the second question in regard to that, I think it's been established that at least to some extent homosexual activity occurs in prisons. Now it would seem to me that since you indicated in your testimony both blood and semen can transfer this, it would seem that that would be another appropriate reason to test this particular population. Now, I may be wrong, but I'd like to have some idea of why you make these decisions on repealing Chapter 434, and you're not presenting the committee, at least at this time, any reason that these statutes are no longer, you know, useful.
The utility of testing would be to find someone to treat them. For AIDS, a treatment isn't readily available. The issue
not
of spreading...
Not a treatment isn't, Christine, but the fact is that, you know, we need to, you know, find methods, legitimate methods, legal methods, to control the spread of the disease. Now, you know, granted there's no treatment other than prevention, and it would seem to me that in a population that, at least in my mind, is prone to those two particular characteristics, drug use and homosexual behavior, you know, at least within the confines of the prison, that one of the things we ought to be doing is looking at mandatory testing. Now, I can be persuaded otherwise, but I need to be persuaded because I'm not convinced at this point.
In direct answer to your point, the testing of people for the presence or absence of a virus will not in and of itself prevent spread of the disease. What prevents spread of the disease is changed behavior, persons not infecting other people. That's why the prisons are a site identified for education. And my staff have worked with the health staff at the Oregon Corrections Facilities to get education regarding AIDS into the prison. That's the key. The behavior that causes the spread of AIDS is, in fact, voluntary behavior. A person decides to engage in drug use or sexual activity, and they can make those decisions in prison as well as outside. Admittedly, from what I read, and I'm sure you read, some of the sexual activity in prisons is not entirely voluntary. And that's one of the reasons that the corrections health people have also been engaged in discussions about whether or not condoms should be available in the prison. That's a difficult decision for them, and one that I think is best made there. This statute doesn't address that one way or the other. Nothing in this statute prohibits AIDS testing in that setting, and we would encourage information about the test to be made available, and where it's appropriate, the same as where it's appropriate for a person in the community, we would want the test to be available, and it is available at no charge.
Okay, there seems to be a basic fallacy in your thinking, that or in mine. I will agree with you that the spreading of AIDS can be prevented by changes in behavior. However, those changes in behavior cannot occur until someone knows whether they are a potential spreader or not. I mean, in part that's true. Granted, we can all have safe sex, I think is the term that is used. But most people aren't going to have safe sex. If they know, however, that they are infected, they personally will take responsible actions. If we don't give them the opportunity in those particular contexts of prison to be aware of that, you know, they probably won't be changing their behavior.
I think you and I are looking at this from slightly different perspectives. If only the people who are currently infected are the ones we expect to change and do safer sex practices, I don't think we'll get ahead of this epidemic. I think anybody who engages in unsafe sex practices or drug use has to change their behavior, whether or not they're infected, for their self-protection or the protection of others. And to me, that education of everybody is what we ought to be spending our money on, not taking the money to find out who's infected and then educating them, because we won't get the net tight enough and we will continue to have spread of the disease.
And you're saying we can't do both, Christy?
Every dollar we choose to spend on testing becomes a trade-off of dollars that would otherwise be spent on education. Our budget is not unlimited, and we are continually balancing those two. And right now, I am not persuaded that universal testing of a population such as those in prison would be a wise use of our dollars.
Representative Van Loon, you had a question.
Okay, and I've got another one or two by now. Earlier in your testimony, I thought you indicated, I thought this dealt some with quarantine, or did you tell us you were removing the quarantine statutes?
No, we are limiting application of the quarantine statutes by introducing a more thorough due process procedure for their application than exists in the present law.
Prior to quarantine?
No, at the time of quarantining.
Okay. Well, then, did you tell us that you could not quarantine a person with AIDS?
No, I did not. I could do that. What I said in answer to a question was there is almost no circumstance in which I would believe that quarantine would be the appropriate step to take for someone with HIV infection, because education and changed behavior are what they need to do, and our evidence and information is that in most cases that will be achieved voluntarily. Quarantine is most used for diseases that are spread through respiratory means, where having the person just walk around the streets sharing rooms with other people puts other people at risk. That's why it's used for tuberculosis, for example. That's where that statute is most made use of today.
Okay. Shifting to my original question, your definition of the toxic substance is any substance that may cause illness, disability, or death to persons who are exposed to it. But if you turn over to page 10, lines 38 to 40, you're talking about when you could bring some sort of something to bear against a person, and in that subsection B, you say that a person where they're carrying something in a conveyance, I assume that could mean a pickup or a vehicle, if there could be, let me see, I've got to go back and get it, causes the passenger and material in the involved conveyance to be subjected to requirements by the Division for the Control of the Specific Communicable Disease or Prevention of Harm to the Public Health from the Toxic Substance. Does that say that you can't have the sack of mouse poison in the back of the pickup that three workers are riding in? I mean, what's your interpretation of this?
My interpretation of that would be a person who was carrying a truckload of a poisonous substance not packaged in anything and blowing off the truck as it went down the highway, causing it to be picked up in other people's cars as they drove by it. That is, they are causing a harm to the public health by that substance.
But this language says, if you look at it closely, it says causes the passengers and material in the involved conveyance to be subjected to thus and so. Any substance that you are going to use that's in the form of a spray or the mouse poison that I referred to or whatever it is, in concentration, in the quantity, or in the bulk, or in the package, or whatever, would be hazardous to somebody if they got it in a hole, but not in if it were applied the way it were supposed to be. So I'm having trouble with this particular definition.
Again, this particular section, again, is taking existing statutory language and trying to update it to the kinds of things that happen today, which are not just germs but also chemical substances, and suggesting that we might wish to stop such a vehicle or otherwise alter the way it's transporting something if it were transporting those things in an unsafe manner, such that they were causing harm to the public's health. Our interest generally is, and sometimes when I say this out loud it sounds very uncaring, is not the harm an individual chooses to do to him or herself privately, but rather the behavior which is causing harm to the people around them. So the fact that a person might want to sit in a vat of poison or carry a vat of poison with them carelessly is not a public health concern, but it is if they're doing it in such a way that it is exposing people in nearby vehicles or along the roadway that they would pass to some kind of hazard.
Bear with me for one more. the original language that was here in this section, would that have been interpreted to say that there was a Greyhound bus traveling on the road and somebody on that bus had a communicable disease and you would do something? What would you have done in that case?
Stop. The fact that you have hit right on the modern version of the place for this, which this was originally designed. They used to stop stagecoaches and search for people who might have smallpox and haul them off the stagecoach before it could go on its way. And the key to that is in line 34, the posing of a substantial threat to public health. And if a person were perceived to be entering the state, traveling in a conveyance, a bus, or public transport of some kind, and causing a threat to public health, they could be removed from it. That is not used very often. It's one of this part of what this statute identifies are the extreme measures, which are hardly ever used, but when needed, you want them to be there so they can be properly put into use to protect the public. They were used more frequently in older years when people were less informed and when there were fewer drugs available to treat people quickly, and people remained a threat longer.
Representative Agron.
Just to lighten up the conversation a little bit, Christine, I was charmed by your statement that what your intentions really are not to protect the individual as much as it is to protect the other innocent people from becoming infected. In other words, the individual is responsible for himself, his own folly, but not for the broad population around him. Did your department or did you personally take a position on motorcycle helmets or seat belts, and how does that philosophy apply? Is it consistent?
You're just waiting to get me back on that one, haven't you?
The chair will rule that okay. Irrelevant. You don't have to answer it, Chris. Other questions that are relevant? Representative French.
Well, if I get this right, what you're saying is that there's not too much use in trying to protect the person, say, who has tuberculosis. If I thought I had tuberculosis, you wouldn't have to quarantine me. I'd be to a medical facility to get that stopped or arrested right now.
Yes.
In the older days, there wasn't too much that person could do for themselves. There wasn't much could be done for them.
And so
a lot of people died from it.
Yes.
So you're simply trying to protect the person who may get it, who may come into contact.
Yes. And once or twice a year in this state, we have somebody with tuberculosis who is not as responsible as you would be, who doesn't take steps to cure themselves and still is putting the people around them at risk, and that's when we bring this statute into play.
Did you have a question, Gordon?
Yeah. Have you checked to see if this bill that your division is proposing impinges upon existing civil liberties?
We have worked on this bill with the American Civil Liberties Union and others with a strong interest in that. I believe you've been given written testimony from the ACLU in support of the bill. They believe that getting this due process into the statute is a protection of civil liberties as compared with the present statute, which in fact leaves them quite vulnerable.
Other questions?
Just one quick question.
Representative Shipwright.
I'm curious about the issue that Christine raised on the costs of the test, and you probably already said what it costs, but could you tell me again what it would cost your department to run a blood test for these diseases?
The blood test for AIDS, just the laboratory piece of it, is relatively small, I don't know, $15 per test. But involved with that is the extensive counseling of the person. This disease causes a lot of confusion, and you don't just walk up, draw a blood test, and do it. You do counseling before and after. My understanding, talking with the county health departments who do that, is that the full cost of the test is somewhere in the nature of $40 per test. And then there are additional confirmatory tests that would have to be done that could drive the cost up toward $100 per person tested. I can give you that in writing.
Christine, in regards to that, when people give blood, aren't they tested, screened for this?
Yes, they are.
And you're saying each time they go in there, they deliver a test that costs upwards of $100?
No. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that.
Well, I'm trying to understand what it is you're saying.
The actual laboratory piece of the test, just running the laboratory test, is somewhere down around $10-$15. And at the Red Cross, that's all they do. They do not engage in individual counseling about the test, other than to tell you in writing when you come in that AIDS is one of the things they'll be screening for. If you've donated blood recently, you'll be aware of that. But where they find a positive, then that kicks over into doing the extensive confirmatory testing, which can run upwards to the $100. In the public health setting, where a person is coming in off the street saying, gee, I've heard about this terrible disease and I think maybe I need to be tested for it, or where you might be testing a broad cut of people and you're getting their informed consent for the test, you then have to engage in extensive counseling about the whys and the wherefores and the behavior changes, and that's what drives the cost up.
Did you have a question, Representative Bailon?
Well, following along with what you were talking about earlier, it almost seems like you're taking the attitude of the ostrich putting his head in the sand when you say you're not going to do the blood test.
I'm trying to apply the blood test where it is needed, and I picture it kind of like a funnel, that everybody in Oregon needs education about this disease and about what he or she can do to protect from the disease. Protecting oneself is the key. You and I can each individually make decisions about IV drug use and sex practices that can fully protect ourselves from the disease. But within that funnel are some people who practice risky behaviors or who have practiced them in the past or who don't know of their risk status. And for those people, testing becomes important as a part of the educational program to identify for them whether or not they have already been infected or not infected. And then in certain very limited circumstances, such as the blood donation, semen donation, and so on, the test is done on every donation in order to protect the recipient of that donation.
But what you're saying, it's much, thank you. It's much more important, of course, for everyone who goes in to donate blood in the blood bank. I mean, that needs to be tested. And that happens regularly on all of us who go in and donate, I think, now.
That is correct.
Okay. But what you're saying is it's such a much more complicated thing to do it on that limited prison population that you're just not going to do it.
The prison population, just doing what they're supposed to be doing in prison, are not putting other people at risk. They only become at risk or put other people at risk if they engage in sex without protection or if they are sharing IV drugs, neither of which are the legally accepted practices in prison. They are a confined population. They are an ideal target for education. They are people who clearly need to know what to do to protect themselves. And if they have been at risk for this disease, if they were using drugs in the community, if they were promiscuous, if they are gay men who think their partner who have been exposed in the community, then the test is just as appropriate for them in prison as it is out of prison. Those are the same people we would test outside of prison, and the test should be available for them. But if the person in prison happens to be a heterosexual male who's been in a monogamous marriage since 1975, who came to jail because of something to do with forgeries, then the test is no more appropriate for that person because he happens to be in prison than it would have been for him walking down the street of some town in Oregon. That's the cut for me. It's the happenstance of being in prison isn't the cardinal feature of why this test needs to be given.
I think the last...
It's clearer than we got it before.
The last newspaper article I read on this said that you're at risk as far back as 15 years. So I'm kind of curious about how many people at the Oregon State Pen have since 1971 been monogamous, not involved in any drug usage, and you are in there for forgery.
If I can clarify that 15 years, I think that was a projection of the latency period of the disease. I don't believe anybody has changed the projection that the virus was first introduced into the United States in the mid to late 1970s. That's the cutoff period we look at.
Okay, but there may be a whole bunch of people out there that are, in fact, carriers of the disease that are unaware because of the long latency period.
That is true. And but again, they're identifiable by the behaviors they've practiced in the intervening years. Multiple partners, use of drugs. And in
Oregon, doesn't that cover quite a few people in our society, Christy? I mean, it's a shame, but I mean, it does cover quite a few people out there, doesn't it?
It does cover quite a few. And the trick is trying to figure out ways to wisely invest our public funds in both educating everybody that there may be quite a few people who are infected and you better watch your behavior all the time, and testing appropriately those who are clearly likely to have been infected and for whom knowledge of their test status will make a difference in the education program.
Okay, I just have this vague disquiet that the health division's attitude towards this problem, as evidenced by this bill, is not much different than the letter to the editor I saw the other day that said the cure for AIDS is abstinence. While it might be, it's pretty impractical, and I'm not so sure that this bill, you know, really moves us in any direction.
This bill is not in and of itself an answer to AIDS. This bill arose out of some look at the statutes associated with AIDS and led me and others to say, we really better go to work on these statutes. But if anybody thinks I'm presenting this statute as Oregon's answer to AIDS, I have done a very bad job in my testimony today. Oregon's answer to AIDS is in $1 million in expenditures for education and for testing, in an extensive network of community